This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Homegoing by Ya Jesse. Read for you by Dominic Hoffman.
Abusiete se kwaye, suu e chiria ohunse, e boom. Se uben wa na ohunse enyano e biesis ni bebinku.
The family is like the forest. If you are outside, it is dense. If you are inside, you see that each tree has its own position. Akan Proverb. Part 1. Efia. The night Efia Otre was born into the musky heat of Fantiland, a fire raged through the woods just outside her father's compound. It moved quickly, tearing a path for days. It lived off the air. It slept in caves and hid in trees. It burned, up and through, unconcerned with what wreckage it left behind, until it reached an Ashanti village. There it disappeared, becoming one with the night. Efia's father, Kobi Otra, left his first wife, Baba, with a new baby, so that he might survey the damage to his yams, that most precious crop known far and wide to sustain families. Kobi had lost 7 yams, and he felt each loss as a blow to his own family. He knew then that the memory of the fire that burned, then fled, would haunt him, his children, and his children's children for as long as the line continued. When he came back into Baba's hut to find Efia, the child of the night's fire, shrieking into the air, he looked at his wife and said, "We will never again speak of what happened today." The villagers began to say that the baby was born of the fire, that this was the reason Baba had no milk. Efia was nursed by Kobi's second wife, who had just given birth to a son 3 months before. Efia would not latch on, and when she did, her sharp gums would tear at the flesh around the woman's nipples until she became afraid to feed the baby. Because of this, Efia grew thinner, skin on small bird-like bones, with a large black hole of a mouth that expelled a hungry cry which could be heard throughout the village. Even on the days Baba did her best to smother it, covering the baby's lips with the rough palm of her left hand. "Love her," Kobi commanded, as though love were as simple an act as lifting food up from an iron plate and past one's lips. At night, Baba dreamed of leaving the baby in the dark forest so that the god Inyami could do with her as he pleased. Efia grew older. The summer after her third birthday, Baba had her first son. The boy's name was Fifi, and he was so fat that sometimes when Baba wasn't looking, Efia would roll him along the ground like a ball. The first day that Baba let Efia hold him, she accidentally dropped him. The baby bounced on his buttocks, landed on his stomach, and looked up at everyone in the room, confused as to whether or not he should cry. He decided against it, but Baba, who had been stirring banku, lifted her stirring stick and beat Efia across her bare back. Each time the stick lifted off the girl's body, it would leave behind hot sticky pieces of banku that burned into her flesh. By the time Baba had finished, Efia was covered with sores, screaming and crying. From the floor, rolling this way and that on his belly, Fifi looked at Efia with his saucer eyes, but made no noise. Kobi came home to find his other wives attending to Efia's wounds and understood immediately what had happened. He and Baba fought well into the night. Efia could hear them through the thin walls of the hut where she lay on the floor, drifting in and out of a feverish sleep. In her dream, Kobi was a lion, and Baba was a tree. The lion plucked the tree from the ground where it stood and slammed it back down. The tree stretched its branches in protest, and the lion ripped them off one by one. The tree, horizontal, began to cry red ants that traveled down the thin cracks between its bark. The ants pooled on the soft earth around the top of the tree trunk. And so the cycle began. Baba beat Ephia. Kobi beat Baba. By the time Ephia had reached age 10, she could recite a history of the scars on her body. The summer of 1764, when Baba broke yams across her back. The spring of 1767, when Baba bashed her left foot with a rock, breaking her big toe so that it now always pointed away from the other toes. For each scar on Ephia's body, there was a companion scar on Baba's. But that didn't stop mother from beating daughter, father from beating mother. Matters were only made worse by Ephia's blossoming beauty. When she was 12, her breasts arrived, two lumps that sprung from her chest as soft as mango flesh. The men of the village knew that first blood would soon follow, and they waited for the chance to ask Baba and Kobi for her hand. The gifts started. One man tapped palm wine better than anyone else in the village, but another's fishing nets were never empty. Kobi's family feasted off Ephia's burgeoning womanhood. Their bellies, their hands, were never empty. In 1775, Ajwa Edu became the first girl of the village to be proposed to by one of the British soldiers. She was light-skinned and sharp-tongued. In the mornings, after she had bathed, she rubbed shea butter all over her body, underneath her breasts and between her legs. Ephia didn't know her well, but she had seen her naked one day when Baba sent her to carry palm oil to the girl's hut. Her skin was slick and shiny, her hair regal. The first time the white man came, Ajwa's mother asked Ephia's parents to show him around the village while Ajwa prepared herself for him. "Can I come?" Ephia asked, running after her parents as they walked. She heard Baba's "no" in one ear and Kobi's "yes" in the other. Her father's ear won, and soon Ephia was standing before the first white man she had ever seen. "He is happy to meet you," the translator said as the white man held his hand out to Ephia. She didn't accept it. Instead, she hid behind her father's leg and watched him. He wore a coat that had shiny gold buttons down the middle. It strained against his paunch. His face was red, as though his neck were a stump on fire. He was fat all over and sweating huge droplets from his forehead and above his upper lip. Ephia started to think of him as a rain cloud, sallow and wet and shapeless. "Please, he would like to see the village," the translator said, and they all began to walk. They stopped first by Ephia's own compound. "This is where we live," Ephia told the white man, and he smiled at her dumbly, his green eyes hidden in fog. He didn't understand. Even after his translator spoke to him, he didn't understand. Kobi held Ephia's hand as he and Baba led the white man through the compound. "Here, in this village," Kobi said, "each wife has her own hut. This is the hut she shares with her children. When it is her husband's night to be with her, he goes to her in her hut." The white man's eyes grew clearer as the translation was given, and suddenly Ephia realized that he was seeing through new eyes. The mud of her hut's walls, the straw of the roof, he could finally see them. They continued on through the village, showing the white man the town square, the small fishing boats formed from hollowed-out tree trunks that the men carried with them when they walked the few miles down to the coast. Ephea forced herself to see things through new eyes, too. She smelled the sea-salt wind as it touched the hairs in her nose, felt the bark of a palm tree as sharp as a scratch, saw the deep, deep red of the clay that was all around them. "Baba," Ephea asked once the men had walked farther ahead of them, "why will Ajwa marry this man?" "Because her mother says so." A few weeks later, the white man came back to pay respects to Ajwa's mother, and Ephea and all the other villagers gathered around to see what he would offer. There was the bride price of 15 pounds. There were goods he'd brought with him from the castle, carried on the backs of Ashantis. Kubi made Ephea stand behind him as they watched the servants come in with fabric, millet, gold, and iron. When they walked back to their compound, Kubi pulled Ephea aside, letting his wives and other children walk in front of them. "Do you understand what just happened?" he asked her. In the distance, Baba slipped her hand into Fifi's. Ephea's brother had just turned 11, but he could already climb up the trunk of a palm tree using nothing but his bare hands and feet for support. "The white man came to take Ajwa away," Ephea said. Her father nodded. "The white man live in the Cape Coast Castle. There they trade goods with our people." "Like iron and millet?" Her father put his hand on her shoulder and kissed the top of her forehead. But when he pulled away, the look in his eyes was troubled and distant. "Yes, we get iron and millet, but we must give them things in return. That man came from Cape Coast to marry Ajwa, and there will be more like him who will come and take our daughters away. But you, my own, I have bigger plans for you than to live as a white man's wife. You will marry a man of our village." Baba turned around just then, and Ephea caught her eyes. Baba scowled. Ephea looked at her father to see if he had noticed, but Kobi did not say a word. Ephea knew who her choice for husband would be, and she dearly hoped her parents would choose the same man. Abeku Badu was next in line to be the village chief. He was tall, with skin like the pit of an avocado, and large hands with long, slender fingers that he waved around like lightning bolts every time he spoke. He had visited their compound 4 times in the last month, and later that week, he and Ephea were to share a meal together. Abeku brought a goat. His servants carried yams and fish and palm wine. Baba and the other wives stoked their fires and heated the oil. The air smelled rich. That morning, Baba had plaited Ephea's hair, 2 long braids on either side of her center part. They made her look like a ram, strong, willful. Ephea had oiled her naked body and put gold in her ears. She sat across from Abeku as they ate, pleased as he stole appreciative glances. "Were you at Ajwa's ceremony?" Baba asked, once all of the men had been served and the women finally began to eat.
"Yes, I was there, but only briefly.
It is a shame Ajwa will be leaving the village. She would have made a good wife." "Will you work for the British when you become chief?" Ephea asked. Kobi and Baba sent her sharp looks, and she lowered her head, but she lifted it to find Abeku smiling. "We work with the British, Ephea, not for them. That is the meaning of trade.
When I am chief, we will continue as we have, facilitating trade with the Ashantis and the British."
Ephea nodded. She wasn't exactly sure what this meant, but she could tell from her parents' looks that it was best to keep her mouth shut. Abeku Badu was the first man they had brought to meet her. Ephea wanted desperately for him to want her. But she did not know yet what kind of man he was, what kind of woman he required. In her hut, Ephea could ask her father and Fifi anything she wanted. It was Baba who practiced silence and preferred the same from Ephea. Baba, who had slapped her for asking why she did not take her to be blessed as all the other mothers did for their daughters. It was only when Ephea didn't speak or question, when she made herself small, that she could feel Baba's love, or something like it. Maybe this was what Abeku wanted too. Abeku finished eating. He shook hands with everyone in the family and stopped by Ephea's mother. "You will let me know when she is ready," he said. Baba clutched a hand to her chest and nodded soberly. Kobi and the other men saw Abeku off as the rest of the family waved. That night, Baba woke Ephea up while she was sleeping on the floor of their hut. Ephea felt the warmth of her mother's breath against her ear as she spoke. "When your blood comes, Ephea, you must hide it. You must tell me and no one else," she said. "Do you understand?" She handed Ephea palm fronds that she had turned into soft rolled sheets. "Place these inside of you, and check them every day. When they turn red, you must tell me." Ephea looked at the palm fronds held in Baba's outstretched hands. She didn't take them at first, but when she looked up again, there was something like desperation in her mother's eyes. And because the look had softened Baba's face somehow, and because Ephea also knew desperation, that fruit of longing, she did as she was told. Every day, Ephea checked for red, but the palm fronds came out greenish-white as always. In the spring, the chief of the village grew ill, and everyone watched Abeku carefully to see if he was ready for the task. He married two women in those months, Arikua the Wise and Millicent, the half-caste daughter of a Fonti woman and a British soldier. The soldier had died from fever, leaving his wife and two children much wealth to do with as they pleased. Ephea prayed for the day all the villagers would call her Ephea the Beauty, as Abeku called her on the rare occasions when he was permitted to speak to her. Millicent's mother had been given a new name by her white husband. She was a plump, fleshy woman, with teeth that twinkled against the dark night of her skin. She had decided to move out of the castle and into the village once her husband died. Because the white men could not leave money in their wills to their Fonti wives and children, they left it to other soldiers and friends, and those friends paid the wives. Millicent's mother had been given enough money for a new start and a piece of land. She and Millicent would often come visit Ephea and Baba, for, as she said, they would soon be a part of the same family. Millicent was the lightest-skinned woman Ephea had ever seen. Her black hair reached down to the middle of her back, and her eyes were tinged with green. She rarely smiled, and she spoke with a husky voice and a strange Fanti accent. "What was it like in the castle?" Baba asked Millicent's mother one day while the four women were sitting to a snack of groundnuts and bananas. "It was fine. Fine. They take care of you, all these men. It is like they have never been with a woman before. I don't know what their British wives were doing. I tell you, my husband looked at me like I was water, and he was fire, and every night he had to be put out." The women laughed. Millicent slipped Ephea a smile, and Ephea wanted to ask her what it was like with Abeku, but she did not dare. Baba leaned in close to Millicent's mother, but still Ephea could hear. "And they pay a good bride price, eh?" "I tell you, My husband paid my mother £10, and that was 15 years ago. To be sure, my sister, the money is good. But I, for one, am glad my daughter has married Afanti. Even if a soldier offered to pay £20, she would not get to be the wife of a chief. And what's worse, she would have to live in the castle, far from me. No, no. It is better to marry a man of the village so that your daughters can stay close to you. Baba nodded and turned toward Efia, who quickly looked away. That night, just 2 days after her 15th birthday, the blood came. It was not the powerful rush of the ocean waves that Efia had expected it to be, but rather a simple trickle, rain dripping, drop by drop, from the same spot of a hut's roof. She cleaned herself off and waited for her father to leave Baba so that she could tell her. "Baba," she said, showing her the palm fronds painted red, "I have gotten my blood." Baba placed a hand over her lips. "Who else knows?" "No one," Efia said. "You will keep it that way, do you understand? When anyone asks you, if you have become a woman yet, you will answer, no." Efia nodded. She turned to leave, but a question was burning hot coals in the pit of her stomach. "Why?" she finally asked. Baba reached into Efia's mouth and pulled out her tongue, pinching the tip with her sharp fingernails. "Who are you that you think you can question me, If you do not do as I say, I will make sure you never speak again." She released Efia's tongue, and for the rest of the night, Efia tasted her own blood. The next week, the old chief died. The funeral announcements went out to all the surrounding villages. The proceedings would last a month and end with Abeku's chief ceremony. The women of the village prepared food from sunrise to sunset. Drums were made out of the finest wood, and the best singers were called upon to raise their voices. The funeral attendants began dancing on the fourth day of the rainy season, and they did not rest their feet until the ground had completely dried. At the end of the first dry night, Abeku was crowned Omanhin, chief of the Fanti village. He was dressed in rich fabrics, his two wives on either side of him. Efia and Baba stood next to each other as they watched, and Kobi paced the crowd. Every so often, Efia could hear him muttering that she, his daughter, the most beautiful woman in the village, should be up there too. As the new chief, Abeku wanted to do something big, something that would bring attention to their village and make them a force to be reckoned with. After only 3 days in office, he gathered all of the men of the village to his compound. He fed them for 2 days straight, got them drunk on palm wine, until their boisterous laughing and impassioned shouting could be heard from every hut. "What will they do?" Efia asked. "That does not concern you," Baba said. In the 2 months since Efia had begun to bleed, Baba had stopped beating her. Payment for her silence. Some days, when they were preparing meals for the men, or when Efia would bring back the water she had fetched and watched Baba dip in with cupped hands, she would think they were finally behaving as mothers and daughters were supposed to behave. But then, other days, the long scowl would return to Baba's face, and Efia would see that her mother's new quiet was only temporary, her rage a wild beast that had been tamed for the moment. Kobi came back from the meeting with a long machete. The handle was gold with carvings of letters that no one understood. He was so drunk that all of his wives and children stood around him in a circle, at a distance of 2 feet, while he shuffled about, jabbing the sharp instrument this way and that.
"We will make the village rich with blood," he screamed. He lunged at Fiefi, who had wandered into the circle, and the boy, leaner and quicker than he had been in his days as a fat baby, swiveled his hips, missing the tip of the machete by only a few inches. Fifi had been the youngest one at the meeting. Everyone knew he would make a fine warrior. They could see it in the way he climbed the palm trees, in the way he wore his silence like a golden crown. After her father left, and Afia was certain that their mother had gone to sleep, she crawled over to Fifi. "Wake up," she hissed, and he pushed her away. Even in half-sleep, he was stronger than she was. She fell backward, but with the grace of a cat, flipped back onto her feet. "Wake up," she said again. Fifi's eyes flashed open. "Don't worry me, big sister," he said. "What will happen?" she asked. "It's the business of men," Fifi said. "You are not yet a man," Afia said. "And you are not yet a woman," Fifi snapped back. "Otherwise, you would have been there with Abeku this very evening as his wife." Afia's lips began to quiver. She turned to go back to her side of the hut, but Fifi caught her arm. "We are helping the British and the Ashantis with their trade." "Oh," Afia said. It was the same story she had heard from her father and Abeku just a few months before. "You mean we will give Ashanti gold and fabric to the white men?" Fifi clutched her tighter. "Don't be stupid," he said. "Abeku has made an alliance with one of the most powerful Ashanti villages. We will help them sell their slaves to the British." And so, the white man came to their village, fat and skinny, red and tanned. They came in uniform, with swords at their sides, their eyes looking sideways, always and ever cautious. They came to approve of the goods Abeku had promised them. In the days following the chief ceremony, Kobi had grown nervous about the broken promise of Efia's womanhood. Nervous that Abeku would forget her in favor of one of the other women in the village. He had always said that he wanted his daughter to be the first, most important wife. But now even third seemed like a distant hope. Every day he would ask Baba what was happening with Efia, and every day Baba would reply that she was not yet ready. In desperation, he decided to allow his daughter to go over to Abeku's compound with Baba once a week, so that the man could see her and remember how much he had once loved her face and figure. Arekwa the Wise, the first of Abeku's wives, greeted them as they came in one evening. "Please, Mama," she said to Baba, "we weren't expecting you tonight. The white men are here." "We can go," Efia said, but Baba clutched her arm. "If you don't mind, we would like to stay," Baba said. Arekwa gave her a strange look. "My husband will be angry if we come back too early," Baba said, as if that were enough of an explanation. Efia knew that she was lying. Kobi had not sent them there that night. It was Baba who had heard that the white men would be there and insisted that they go pay respects. Arekwa took pity and left to ask Abeku if the two of them might stay. "You will eat with the women, and if the men come in, you will not speak," she said when she had returned. She led them deeper into the compound. Efia watched hut after hut pass by until they entered the one where the wives had gathered to eat. She sat next to Millicent, whose pregnant belly had begun to show, no bigger than a coconut, slung low. Arekwa had prepared fish in palm oil stew, and they dug in until their fingers were stained orange. Soon, a maidservant Efia had not noticed before came into the room. She was a tiny girl, only a child,
whose eyes never lifted from the ground. "Please, Mama," she said to Arekwa. "The white men would like to tour the compound. Chief Abeku says you are to make sure you are presentable for them." "Go and fetch us water quick," Millicent said. And when the servant came back with a bucket full of water, they all washed their hands and lips. Ephea tidied her hair, licking her palms and rubbing her fingers along the tight baby curls that lined her edges. When she finished, Baba had her stand between Millicent and Arekwa, in front of the other women, and Ephea tried her best to seem smaller so as not to draw attention to herself. Before long, the men came in. Abeku looked as a chief should look, Ephea thought, strong and powerful, like he could lift 10 women above his head and toward the sun. 2 white men came in behind him. There was one who Ephea thought must be the chief of the white men, because of the way the other glanced at him before he moved or spoke. This white chief wore the same clothes as the rest of them wore, but there were more shiny golden buttons running along his coat and on the flaps above his shoulders. He seemed older than Abeku, his dark brown hair flecked with gray, but he stood up straight, as a leader should stand. "These are the women, my wives and children, the mothers and daughters," Abeku said. The smaller, more timid white man watched him carefully as he said this, and then turned to the white chief and spoke their strange tongue. The white chief nodded and smiled at all of them, looking carefully at each woman and saying hello in his poor Fanti. When his hello reached Ephea, she couldn't help but giggle. The other women shushed her, and embarrassment like heat began to move into her cheeks.
"I'm still learning,"
the white chief said, resting his eyes on Ephea, his Fanti an ugly sound in her ears. He held her gaze for what seemed like minutes, and Ephea felt her skin grow even hotter as the look in his eyes turned into something more wanton. The dark brown circles of his irises looked like large pots that toddlers could drown in, and he looked at Ephea just like that, as though he wanted to keep her there, in his drowning eyes. Color quickly flooded into his cheeks. He turned to the other white man and spoke.
"No, she is not my wife," Abeku said after the man had translated for him, his voice not bothering to hide his annoyance.
Ephea hung her head, embarrassed that she had done something to cause Abeku shame. Embarrassed he could not call her wife. Embarrassed, too, that he had not called her by name. Ephea, the beauty. She wanted desperately then to break her promise to Baba and announce herself as the woman she was. But before she could speak, the men walked away, and her nerve faded as the white chief looked over his shoulder at her and smiled. His name was James Collins, and he was the newly appointed governor of the Cape Coast Castle. Within a week, he had come back to the village to ask Baba for Ephea's hand in marriage. Kobe's rage at the proposal filled every room like hot steam. "She is all but promised to Abeku," he yelled at Baba when Baba told him that she was considering the offer. "Yes, but Abeku cannot marry her until her blood comes, and we have been waiting years now. I tell you, husband, I think she was cursed in that fire, a demon who will never become a woman. Think about it. What creature is that beautiful but cannot be touched? All of the signs of womanhood are there, and yet still nothing. The white man will marry her regardless. He does not know what she is." Ephea had heard the white man talking to her mother earlier that day. He would pay £30 up front, and 25 shillings a month in tradable goods to Baba as bride gift. More than even Abeku could offer. more than had been offered for any other Fanti woman in this village or the next. Ephir could hear her father pacing all throughout the evening. She even awoke the next morning to that same sound, the steady rhythm of his feet on the hard clay earth. "We must make Abeku think it was his idea," he finally said. And so, the chief was called to their compound. He sat beside Kubi as Baba told him her theory, that the fire that had destroyed so much of their family's worth had also destroyed the child. "She has the body of a woman, but something evil lurks in her spirit," Baba said, spitting on the ground for emphasis. "If you marry her, she will never bear you children. If the white man marries her, he will think of this village fondly, and your trade will prosper from it." Abeku rubbed his beard carefully as he thought about it. "Bring the beauty to me," he said finally. Kobi's second wife brought Ephir into the room. She was trembling, and her stomach pained her so much that she thought she might empty her bowels right there in front of everyone. Abeku stood up so that he was facing her. He ran his fingers along the full landscape of her face, the hills of her cheeks, the caves of her nostrils. "A more beautiful woman has never been born," he said finally. He turned to Baba. "But I see that you are right. If the white man wants her, he may have her. All the better for our business with them. All the better for the village." Kobi, big, strong man that he was, began to weep openly. But Baba stood tall. She walked over to Ephir after Abeku had left, and handed her a black stone pendant that shimmered as though it had been coated in gold dust. She slipped it into Ephir's hands, and then leaned into her until her lips were touching Ephir's ear. "Take this with you when you go," Baba said. "A piece of your mother." And when Baba finally pulled away, Ephir could see something like relief dancing behind her smile. Ephir had passed by the Cape Coast castle only once, when she and Baba ventured out of their village and into the city, but she had never been in it before the day of her wedding. There was a chapel on the ground level, and she and James Collins were married by a clergyman who had asked Ephir to repeat words she didn't mean in a language she didn't understand. There was no dancing, no feasting, no bright colors, slicked hair, or old ladies with wrinkled and bare breasts throwing coins and waving handkerchiefs. Not even Ephir's family had come. For after Baba had convinced them all that the girl was a bad omen, no one wanted anything to do with her. The morning she left for the castle, Kobi had kissed the top of her head and waved her away, knowing that the premonition of the dissolution and destruction of the family lineage, the premonition that he had had the night of the fire, would begin here, with his daughter and the white man. For his part, James had done all he could to make Ephir comfortable. She could see how much he tried. He had gotten his interpreter to teach him even more words in Fanti, so that he could tell her how beautiful she was, how he would take care of her as best he could. He had called her what Abeku called her, Ephir, the beauty. After they were married, James gave Ephir a tour of the castle. On the ground floor of the north wall, there were apartments and warehouses. The center held the parade ground, soldiers' quarters, and guard room. There was a stockyard, a pond, a hospital, a carpenter's shop, smithy, and kitchen. The castle was itself a village. Ephir walked around with James in complete awe, running her hands along the fine furniture made from wood the color of her father's skin, the silk hanging so smooth they felt like a kiss. She breathed everything in, stopping at the gun platform that held huge black cannons facing out toward the sea. She wanted to rest before James led her up his private stairwell, and so she laid her head down against one of those cannons for just a moment. Then she felt a breeze hit her feet from small holes in the ground. "What's below?" she asked James, and the mangled Fonte word that came back to her was cargo. Then, carried up with the breeze, came a faint crying sound. So faint, Ephia thought she was imagining it, until she lowered herself down, rested her ear against the grate. "James, are there people down there?" she asked. Quickly James came to her. He snatched her up from the ground and grabbed her shoulders, looking straight into her eyes. "Yes," he said evenly. It was one Fonte word he had mastered. Ephia pulled away from him. She stared back into his piercing eyes. "But how can you keep them down there crying, she said.
"You white people! My father warned me about your ways. Take me home. Take me home right now."
She didn't realize she'd been screaming until she felt James's hand on her mouth, pushing her lips as though he could force the words back in. He held her like that for a long time, until she had calmed. She didn't know if he understood what she said, but she knew then, just by the faint push of his fingers on her lips, that he was a man capable of hurting, that she should be glad to be on one side of his meanness, and not another.
"You want to go home?"
James asked, his Fonte firm, though unclear. "Your home is no better." Ephia pulled his hand from her mouth and stared at him for a while longer. She remembered her mother's joy at seeing her leave, and knew that James was right. She couldn't go home. She nodded, only barely. He hurried her up the stairs. On the very top floor were James's quarters. From the window, Ephia could see straight out to the sea. Cargo ships, like black specks of dust in the blue, wet eye of the Atlantic, floated so far out that it was difficult to tell how far away from the castle the ships actually were. Some were maybe 3 days away, others merely an hour. Ephia watched a ship just like this once she and James finally got to his room. A flickering of yellow light announced its presence on the water. And with that light, Ephia could just barely make out the boat's silhouette, long and curved, like the hollowed-out skin of a coconut. She wanted to ask James what the ship was carrying, and whether it was coming or going. But she had grown tired of trying to decipher his Fonte. James said something to her. He smiled when he spoke. A peace offering. The corners of his lips twitched almost imperceptibly. She shook her head, tried to tell him that she didn't understand, and finally, he gestured to the bed in the left-hand corner of the room. She sat. Baba had explained what would be expected of her on her wedding night before she had left for the castle that morning, but it seemed no one had explained it to James. When he approached her, his hands were trembling, and she could see the sweat building on his forehead. She was the one who laid her body down. She was the one who lifted her skirt. They went on like this for weeks until eventually, the comfort of routine began to dull the ache that missing her family had left her with. Ephia didn't know what it was about James that soothed her. Perhaps it was the way he always answered her questions, or the affection he showed her. Perhaps it was the fact that James had no other wives there to attend to, and so every one of his nights belonged to her. She had cried the first time he brought her a gift. He had taken the black stone pendant that Baba had given her, and put it on a string so that Ephia could wear it around her neck. touching the stone always gave her great comfort. Ephia knew she was not supposed to care for James, and she kept hearing her father's words echoing through her mind, how he had wanted more for her than to be the Fanti wife of a white man. She remembered, too, how close she had come to really being someone. Her whole life, Baba had beat her and made her feel small, and she had fought back with her beauty, a silent weapon, but a powerful one, which had led her to the feet of a chief. But ultimately, her mother had won, cast her out, not only of the house but of the village entirely. So that now, the only other Fantis she saw regularly were the spouses of the other soldiers. She'd heard the Englishmen call them wenches, not wives. Wife was a word reserved for the white women across the Atlantic. Wench was something else entirely. A word the soldiers used to keep their hands clean so that they would not get in trouble with their god, a being who himself was made up of three, but who allowed men to marry only one. "What is she like?" Ephia asked James one day. They had been trading languages. In the early mornings, before he went off to oversee the work of the castle, James would teach her English, and at night, when they lay in bed, she taught him Fanti. This night, he was tracing his finger along the curve of her collarbone, while she sang him a song that Baba used to sing Fiafi at night, as Ephia lay in the corner, pretending to be asleep, pretending not to care that she was never included. Slowly, James had started to mean more to her than a husband was supposed to mean to a wife. The first word he had asked her to learn was love, and he said it every day. "Her name is Anne," he said, moving his finger from Ephia's collarbone to her lips. "I haven't seen her in so long. We were married 10 years ago, but I've been away for so many of those years. I hardly know her at all." Ephia knew that James had two children in England as well, Emily and Jimmy. They were ages 5 and 9, conceived in the few days he was on leave and able to see his wife. Ephia's father had 20 children. The old chief had had nearly 100. That a man could be happy with so few seemed unfathomable to her. She wondered what the children looked like. She wondered, too, what Anne wrote James in those letters of hers. They came at unpredictable intervals. 4 months here, 1 month there. James would read them at his desk at night while Ephia pretended to be sleeping. She didn't know what the letters said, but every time James read one, he would come back to bed and lie as far away from her as possible. Now, without the force of a letter to keep him away, James was resting his head on her left breast. When he spoke, his breath was hot, a wind that traveled the length of her stomach down between her legs. "I want children with you," James said, and Ephia cringed, worried that she would not be able to fulfill this want, worried, too, that because she had a bad mother, she herself would become one. She had already told James about Baba's scheme, how she had forced Ephia to keep her womanhood a secret so that she would seem unfit for the men of her village. But James had just laughed her sadness away. "All the better for me," he said. And yet, Ephia had started to believe that perhaps Baba was right. She'd lost her virginity on the night of her wedding, but months had passed without a pregnancy. The curse may have been rooted in a lie, but perhaps it bore the fruit of truth. The old people of her village used to tell a story about a woman who was said to have been cursed. She lived under a palm tree on the northwest side, and no one had ever called her by her name. Her mother had died so that she might live. And on her 10th birthday, she had been carrying a pot of boiling hot oil from one hut to another. Her father was napping on the ground, and she, thinking that she could step over him instead of going around, tripped, spilling the hot oil onto his face and disfiguring him for the rest of his life, which lasted only 25 more days. She was banished from the house, and she wandered the Gold Coast for years, until she returned at age 17, a strange, rare beauty. Thinking that perhaps she no longer courted death wherever she went, a boy who had known her when she was young offered to marry her as she was, destitute and without family. She conceived within a month, but when the baby came out, it was half-caste. Blue-eyed and light-skinned, it died 4 days later. She left her husband's house the night of the child's death and went to live under the palm tree, punishing herself for the rest of her life. Ifea knew that the elderly of her village only told this story to warn the children to take care when around hot oil. But she wondered about the end of the story. The half-caste child. How this child, both white and black, was an evil powerful enough to force the woman out into the forest of palms. When Ajua had married the white soldier, and when Millicent and her mother had wandered into the village, Kobe turned up his nose. He had always said that the joining of a man and a woman was also the joining of two families. Ancestors, whole histories, came with the act. But so did sins and curses. The children were the embodiment of that unity, and they bore the brunt of it all. What sins did the white man carry with him? Baba had said that Ifea's curse was one of a failed womanhood. But it was Kobe who had prophesied about a sullied lineage. Ifea couldn't help but think that she was fighting against her own womb, fighting against the fire children. "If you don't give that man children soon, he will take you right back," Ajua said. She and Ifea had not been friends when they lived in the village, but here they saw each other as often as possible, each happy to be near someone who understood her, to hear the comforting sounds of her regional tongue. Ajua had already had 2 children since leaving the village. Her husband, Todd Phillips, had only gotten fatter since Ifea had last seen him, sweaty and red in Ajwa's old hut. "I tell you, oh, Todd has kept me flat on my back since I arrived in this place. I am probably expecting right now as we speak." Ifea shuddered. "But his stomach is so big," she said, and Ajua laughed until she choked on the groundnuts she was eating. "Eh, but the stomach is not the part you use to make the baby," she said. "I will give you some roots from the woods. You put them under the bed when you lie with him. Tonight, you must be like an animal when he comes into the room, a lioness. She mates with her lion, and he thinks the moment is about him when it is really about her, her children, her posterity. Her trick is to make him think that he is king of the bush. But what does a king matter? Really, she is king and queen and everything in between. Tonight, we will make you live up to your title, beauty." And so Ajua came back with roots. They were no ordinary roots. They were large and swelled, and when you pulled back one strand, another would appear to take its place. Ifea put them under the bed, and they only seemed to multiply, spilling leg after leg out until it seemed the root would pick the bed up on its back and walk away, a strange new spider. "Your husband should not be able to see any of it," Ajua said, and they worked to push back the strands of root that insisted on picking out, pushing and pulling, until finally it was contained. Then Adjoa helped Ephia prepare for James. She plaited and smoothed her hair, and spread oil on her skin, and red clay on the apples of her cheeks and the curve of her lips. Ephia made sure that when James came in that night, the room smelled earthy and lush, like something there could bear fruit.
"What's all this?"
James asked. He was still in his uniform, and Ephia could tell that he'd had a long day by the way his lapel drooped. She helped him pull off his coat and shirt, and she pressed her body against his, as Adjoa had taught her. Before he could register his surprise, she grabbed his arms and pushed him to the bed. Not since their first night together had he been this timid, afraid of her unfamiliar body, the full-figured flesh, so different from how he had described his wife. Excited now, he pushed into her, and she squeezed her eyes as tightly as she could, her tongue circling her lips. He pushed harder, his breathing heavy and labored. She scratched his back, and he cried out. She bit his ear and pulled his hair. He pushed against her as though he were trying to move through her. And when she opened her eyes to look at him, she saw something like pain written across his face and the ugliness of the act. The sweat and blood and wetness they produced became illuminated, and she knew that if she was an animal tonight, then he was too. Once they had finished, Ephia lay with her head on James's shoulder. "What is that?" James asked, turning his head. They had moved the bed so that now three strands of the root were exposed.
"Nothing,"
Ephia said. James jumped up and peered underneath the bed.
"What is it, Ephia?"
he asked again, his voice more forceful than she had ever heard it before.
"It's nothing. A root that Adjoa gave me, for fertility."
His lips formed a thin line.
"Now, Ephia, I don't want any voodoo or black magic in this place. My men can't hear that I let my wench place strange roots under the bed. It's not Christian."
Ephia had heard him say this before. Christian. That was why they had been married in the chapel by the stern man in black who shook his head every time he looked at her. He'd spoken before, too, of the voodoo he thought all Africans participated in. She could not tell him the fables of Anansi the spider, or stories that the old people from her village used to tell her without his growing wary. Since moving to the castle, she'd discovered that only the white men talked of black magic, as though magic had a color. Ephia had seen a traveling witch who carried a snake around her neck and shoulders. This woman had had a son. She'd sung lullabies to him at night, and held his hands and kept him fed, same as anyone else. There was nothing dark about her. The need to call this thing good, and this thing bad, this thing white, and this thing black, was an impulse that Ephia did not understand. In her village, everything was everything. Everything bore the weight of everything else. The next day, Ephia told Adjoa that James had seen the root.
"That is not good," Adjoa said. "Did he call it evil?"
Ephia nodded, and Adjoa clicked her tongue three times. Todd would have said the same thing. These men could not tell good from evil if they were Inyami himself. "I don't think it will work now, Ephia. I'm sorry." But Ephia wasn't sorry. If she was barren, so be it. Soon, even James was too busy to worry about children. The castle was expecting a visit from Dutch officers, and everything needed to run as smoothly as possible. James would wake up well before Ephia to help the men with the imported store items and to see to the ships. Ephia spent more and more time wandering around the villages surrounding the castle, roaming the forests, and chatting with Adjoa. The afternoon of the Dutch arrival, Ephia met with Ajwa and some of the other wenches just outside the castle. They stopped beneath the shade of a patch of trees in order to eat yams with pot.